What does elk antler elixir have to do with Ernest Hemingway?
The short answer is absolutely nothing. But I have a character in the novel who distributes elk antler to residents in the Madison Valley. And she is somebody who used to trade with one of her patients. She calls them her patients. And he had access to Ernest Hemingway's fishing gear. And she got that in trade for giving him some elk antler. White velvet, as they call it.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Keith McCafferty about Cold Hearted River, his sixth mystery novel in the Sean Stranahan series. The following program contains some adult content which may be unsuitable for children. Listener discretion is advised. I want to get to the Ernest Hemingway part of the mystery, but before that, for the readers who are unfamiliar with the Sean Stranahan series, can you give us just a little update about where we find Sean now?
Well, where you find him is where you always find him, which is in southwest Montana, in a fictional county and that it really serves as Madison County. And I deliberately made him someone from the East so that he could come and see sort of the changing West with fresh eyes. And he's still not married, but he has a relationship with Martha Ettinger, who's sort of my co-main character.
How did you come across his name?
Well, that was the easiest thing, because I used to write under the name Sean Stranahan. That was my pseudonym. Because in the old days, when I would write for Field & Stream or other magazines, if I had more than one or two articles in a particular issue, they would want me to write the third under a pseudonym. And a kid I went to college with was named Stranahan, and I simply chose the first name. And I entered, the first time I ever used it, I'd entered a writing contest at the University of Michigan in graduate school, and I won. And my present for winning this prize, or whatever you want to call it, was to drive up to upstate Michigan and hunt snowshoe rabbits on snowshoes with a basset hound. So last year, I was very fortunate to have won the Western Writers of America Spur Award for Crazy Mountain Kiss, and I had to give a speech to the assembled people there at their gathering. And I said, well, you know, holding up the plaque with the spur on it, I said, this is only my second best trophy I've ever earned. The first was hunting with a basset hound.
So I think maybe the best way to get into the book is to have you read the preface.
Certainly. I first heard about Ernest Hemingway's steamer trunk of fishing tackle, the lost treasure chest at the heart of this novel, from his oldest son, Jack. Jack and I were contributing editors for Field & Stream some 30-odd years ago, and though not close friends, we shared a river from time to time. It was a blustery November day, easy to recall because all November days on British Columbia's Thompson River are blustery. And we were the only fishermen along a stretch of the river known as the Graveyard, just down the hill from the old white crosses where all the graves face north. On towards dark, Jack hooked a steelhead of 15 or 16 pounds, which I landed for him in the tailout after a long fight. We admired this great seafaring trout for a few seconds before releasing it, and celebrated with a thermos cup of hot chocolate into which I laced peppermint schnapps in honor of my father. After toasting the fish, I asked Jack if he thought his own father would have liked this kind of fishing, that is, wading on slippery boulders in a river haunted by the dead, casting hour after hour in miserable weather, and considering yourself lucky to hook up once every few days and manage not to drown. He said that Ernest would have enjoyed the challenge, but that he'd lost the heart to fly fish after a steamer trunk containing all his valuable gear was stolen or lost from Railway Express in 1940, en route to Ketchum, Idaho, where he was a guest at the Sun Valley Lodge. In fact, Jack could only remember his father fly fishing once after that loss, in the Big Wood River. This was an interesting insight into the famous author's psyche, but at the time I was more interested in casting my own fly rod than the fate of another man's tackle or the sentiments it evoked. Years passed, and I had no reason to recall the story until my wife, Gail, persuaded me to set a novel in northwestern Wyoming, where Hemingway stayed at the Elbartee Guest Ranch during 5 summers and falls in the 1930s, hunting, fishing, and writing. By then, Jack had died, and I sought to verify the details of his story with Patrick Hemingway, Ernest's sole surviving son, who lives in my hometown. I spoke with him at a local screening of the PBS American Masters series film, Ernest Hemingway, Rivers to the Sea. Patrick was kind enough to indulge my questions and said that he recalled the lost trunk, adding that it probably contained best quality bamboo fly rods and reels ordered from the House of Hardy catalog. Hardy was the premier London maker, and Patrick remembered helping his father convert the prices from pound sterling to American dollars. Today, only one piece of Ernest Hemingway's fly fishing tackle survives in good condition, a Hardy fly rod in a model called the Fairy that he had with him when he first went to Idaho. It is displayed at the American Museum of Fly Fishing in Manchester, Vermont, along with a letter to Field and Stream that Jack wrote about the missing tackle. As concerns the possibility that the trunk contained Hemingway treasures unrelated to piscatorial pursuits, and perhaps of far greater value, there is one way to find out. Pour a drink, light a fire, and turn the page. I have a story to tell. I would add that that was not the only thing that Jack told me. He also said, Papa liked to say that all true stories end in death. I think the idea of fishing in a graveyard would have appealed to him. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing he told me when he caught the great fish.
Which makes me think about the theme of virility and mortality in the book.
That's right. And desperation. All the characters are desperate in one way or another. And Hemingway, of course, was very concerned with mortality, almost fixated on death, and very much aware that he was alive and that you only had one life to go around in.
How did your relationship to Hemingway change over the course of writing the book?
Well, I had to do a lot of research for it. And I am very lucky because down the street from me is Valerie Hemingway, who was Ernest's secretary and confidant and traveling companion for the last 2 years of his life, more or less, not right up until the end. And so she proofread the book and, you know, made sure. And she also, as a result of my relationship with her, she was able to get me into Ernest Hemingway's home, the Finca Vigia in Cuba, in Havana. And that was very helpful as well. You know, when you start writing a novel, you have to realize it's going to take at least 8 months of your life. So you better write about something that means something to you. I always try to do that. And Hemingway is one of the most fascinating writers in American history. And here was a story that virtually no one knew. Everybody knows about the lost papers that Hadley lost back in the 1920s, but nobody knows about this. So I thought, that's a very good subject, and I think I can live with Ernest Hemingway for 8 more months.
I'm really curious because you knew about the lost fishing gear, and it wasn't until your wife, Gail, sort of prodded you. Do you think sometimes it takes books or creative projects, they have to sort of mature, you have to, you know, they're like eggs that you have to sort of like warm up and then they hatch, or?
My wife, of course, wanted to do this story.
Yeah,
and so we started talking about Hemingway, and she would be on book tour with me a little bit, and we were driving and driving and trying to come up with titles, and she came up with the title Cold Hearted River. And of course, even before that, I had remembered what Jack had told me, and I thought, well, that's a good idea, but you know, you run a risk if you're going to have some character perhaps like Hemingway in a book, someone who believes that they can summit his spirit as well as his pen. I think you run the risk of making a fool out of yourself. And the other thing was, it's like Day of the Jackal. Everybody knows that Charles de Gaulle did not die by a sniper's bullet. But Frederick Forsyth pulled off that wonderful book, The Day of the Jackal, despite that. Well, I would be going in here because nobody has ever found that tackle. But it's out there somewhere.
Mm-hmm. One of your characters describes Hemingway in detail in this passage, and I'll ask you a question afterwards.
Sure.
Hemingway, the person, is among the most misunderstood, vilified, and yet most celebrated Americans of his generation, and I would venture among the most iconic figures of the 20th century. He defined the American male, was labeled a misogynist, yet his relationships were with strong women, and he championed their accomplishments. So first of all, if you were to help Hemingway be more understood, what would you say?
You mean today?
Yeah.
I would say that you can't judge people. You have to judge people in the era in which they lived, not by today's standards, and realize that Ernest Hemingway was an extraordinarily complicated person. He was very shy. He was a bookworm. He was a bore. He was a bully. He was the best friend you'd ever have and not the best friend you'd ever had. But the overriding thing that you come away with when you talk to people who knew Ernest or lived with him, like Valerie, was that he was the most fascinating person you would ever be around. And, you know, our heroes cannot really withstand close scrutiny in a way. The most interesting people are not maybe the best people by some regards. And he had a little bit of everything floating around. And was scared to death of the dark, did not like to sleep alone. One of his excuses for having maybe a few affairs, but my wife didn't go for that one. But but an extraordinarily complicated man. And I think some people thought, well, you know, too much drinking sort of cut his career short. But I would argue that his output is remarkable in light of the challenges he faced from injuries. Not many people know this, but he was in two plane crashes in one day in Africa and actually had brain matter come out his ears several days later. And he never really recovered from that. He had the list of his injuries just goes on and on and on and on. So yes, some people think he was manic depressive or what we call bipolar, or even schizophrenic. But the fact is, he had brain damage, and he continued to do some remarkable work even after that.
Speaking of not sleeping alone, Sean manages to find himself involved, or at least the book references, several middle-aged women whose doors are wide open to him. And I'm just really curious, what's that a reflection of?
A young man who lives by himself.
And is it, I was also wondering, is this reflective of a culture in Montana of middle-aged women who are also
well,
solo?
Well, you know, I have always been drawn more to middle-aged women than young women, going all the way back to when I was a little kid. So that's my own peculiar idiosyncrasy. So when I write female characters, I am not as interested in very young people as I am in women, let's say, of a certain age, who can still be very sexual and very exciting, you know. That's simply a reflection of my own taste, I suppose you could say. Another reason that I don't give Sean being married to Martha right now or anything, everybody thinks that if you give your character a wife or a husband, depending, you sort of kill on any sexual tension, and that's why you don't do it. But the real reason is that if you have a wife, where is the wife? So you have to address that fact. And unless the wife is part of the story, she just slows it down. The same thing can be said for a dog.
Right.
If a young man has a dog, and every young man in Montana seems to have a dog, where's the dog? I would write in the margins, where's the damn dog? Because he's got a dog he inherited, Chody, which means small in Hindi, which is named after a good friend of mine, Chody. And I have to, is the dog in the front seat of the truck? Is the dog in his teepee? Is the dog with Martha? Is the dog with the Madison River Liars and Fly Tires Club? You have to think about it because readers will ask, where was
the
dog?
What happened to the dog? Yeah. If you're just joining us, you've been listening to a conversation with Keith McCafferty about his book, Cold-Hearted River. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. What is a big sky moment?
Well, something that's sort of iconically Montanan. I think people meeting on riverbanks while they're fishing and exchanging a few words is almost quintessentially Montanan. It does happen in other places, but you go back east, it doesn't happen like that, you know. And then developing relationships from there. One of my good friends, John Izzard, who I used his name in the first chapter of my very first book, he's from Atlanta, Georgia. I met him, he was wearing waders in a grocery store at night in Bozeman. I started to talk to him, and I've been fishing with him, and, you know, that's just the way things go. I think it's an interesting phenomenon. Once the hunting writer, David Petzl, came to visit me to go on an elk hunt, he wanted me to acclimate him to the altitude. And while I was talking to him in the hotel parking lot, some guy whose wife was at a convention came out, and because he saw him wearing wool or whatever, he just started to strike up a conversation with Dave and me about hunting. And when he left, Dave said, "People like that scare me. Nobody would ever do that back east, just walk up to a stranger and just start talking about hunting or fishing."
Waders are the international signal of friendliness,
right?
Maybe.
If you carry a fly rod while you're hitchhiking, you can get a ride.
Where's the most remarkable place you've hitchhiked with a fly rod?
Hitchhiked? A couple. One is I wanted to go to the cradle of American fly fishing, which are the Catskill Mountains in New York. And I hitchhiked there from Ohio when I was about 19 years old and lived out of my backpack. And I also used to hitchhike and jump trains to fish a creek called Cross Creek, which was a smallmouth bass stream back in southeastern Ohio where I grew up. I'd wait till the train coming was really slow, and then I'd jump on a flat car. And then when it was time to jump off the train to fish a stretch, I'd have to throw the rod off first to work up the courage to jump off the train. So I guess right. I hitched
trains. If the rod was off the train, you had to go after it.
I had to go after it, right. Lucky I'm alive.
Who brought you into the fishing world?
My dad did, and his parents had no interest in fishing, his father. But my dad did, and he liked the great fishing writer, the fishing editor of Field & Stream, who was Al McLean. And so my goal when I was young was to meet Al McLean, to impress him, to marry his daughter, he had a beautiful young daughter, and to take his job as the fishing editor of Field & Stream. And how to impress him, he was one of the few people in the world who could take a 90-foot fly line and cast the entire line without a rod. I learned how to do that. And at a certain point, I was a junior contributor to Field & Stream, and he was an editor emeritus, and I was supposed to meet him on the banks of the Madison River, actually, in a cabin. And he died unexpectedly, and which was very sad for me and, of course, for his family. But so I never met Al McLean. I never impressed him. I never married his daughter. And I didn't exactly take his job, but I came close. I ended up writing 1,500 or so articles for Field & Stream and counting.
There's a quote in the book about fishing between fathers and sons. Mm-hmm. The sentence goes, "Fishing had become the solitary grace note in their relationship."
Well, I think I probably took that from my own life. My dad was a World War II veteran, had driven trains throughout Europe, and the easy social graces and talking conversation was hard for him. But whenever he was on the river with me, his voice just changed, and he became very calm, and especially during those turbulent years when you're a teenager. that was so remarkable. It really did become the grace note, you know. It wasn't maybe the solitary one, but that came from my own life.
Nice. There's a theme of lodestones in the book.
Something that brings you back.
Yeah. Do you have a personal lodestone?
Do I? Yes. I have several, but one is definitely the Osawa River in Michigan, where I more or less grew up. And in fact, in this June-July issue of Field and Stream, there's a long narrative reminiscence I write about that river and what it meant to me. Because I started camping on the bank of that river when I was 1 year old, and it meant various things to me at various times in my life. You know, it was a river of firsts, you know, I say, you know, first trout, first kiss, first beer too many, you know, first Mosaga rattlesnake. I found a Mosaga rattlesnake on the edge of a sandy road, and I pinned his head down and picked it up. I'm a snake person. I love snakes. And held it, and I can remember that tail vibrating in the palm of my hand, and I carried it a couple hundred feet away and released it just so it wouldn't get hit by a car. And like I wrote later, just a couple months ago, I think of all the firsts, all the things that happened to me when I lived on that river, that was probably the least dangerous.
That's remarkable. I know that one of the maybe pseudo-complaints you've received is that there's not enough Sean fishing scenes in your work anymore.
Well, actually, there's a couple in this river, two or three in this book. When I wrote my first book, there were several in it, and Catherine Court, who's the president and publisher of Penguin, and also my own personal editor, thought there was maybe one or two too many, so I eliminated two.
Yeah.
When I wrote The Gray Ghost Murders, my second book, she suggested I put another one in. We walk a very fine line. I know that I lose some women readers because they think these are books about fishing. They're not books about fishing. I don't write fly fishing mysteries. I write mystery books in which there's a very, very small amount of fly fishing. And so I can't write down to people who know. For example, I can't write a book called The Royal Wolf Murder and have a fly that is not a royal wolf on the cover, which is initially what they wanted to put on there. I said, no. But at the same time, I can't write technically and bore people who have no interest. The fact is, from what I'm told and from I communicate with a large number of readers. I write to everybody who writes to me. It seems to me that most of my readers are men and women, but particularly women of a certain age, let's say, from 40 on up to my oldest was 101, Mary. And that may seem a little unusual for books like mine, but it's really not. And in fact, that's the reading public for pretty much anybody, anything except fantasy fiction, are women of a certain age, so who have no interest in fishing. Yes, I sell a lot of books to women who are giving it to their husband or whatever, but for the most part, no. They just like to read.
Do you feel like you're getting out on the river enough these days?
No, I don't get out on the river hardly at all. I fish through my fans, as I say, but I'm just meaning my readers. I always ask them where they're fishing, and you know. I was given this opportunity to write this series of books. Well, I made the opportunity by writing the first book, and I felt like I don't want to have the one regret in my life being not taking advantage of it. So I wish that I could write the books in 6 months and have 3 months or 4 months to fish or just to do other things. But the fact is I barely get them done in time because it's very hard work.
Yes.
I used to think that, I've been a magazine editor. I've, you know, been a part of 5 or 6 national magazine awards. You know, I know how to do this. This is just as legitimate as writing the novels. But no, a long article for a magazine is 4,000 to 6,000 words. That's New Yorker length. A novel's 90,000 to 120,000. Mine generally fall around 95,000. So if you write yourself into a corner at 5,000 words, you just back out and write it again. If you write yourself into a corner at 60,000 words, you're sort of screwed. Then you have to go back and do it again.
Yeah. What do you hope your legacy will be?
I never really think of my legacy. I don't even know if that I'd have one. And I was only aware of it, became aware of it a couple months ago when the curator of the special collections at Montana State University wanted me to donate all my papers and stuff to their place where they'd be stored for posterity and, you know, climate-controlled place. And I thought, I'm not worth that. But, I do touch people's lives through what I write. And I'll get, you know, letters from people say, well, you really strengthened the bond between a father and a son. Or a woman will call me up and say, your books are the only thing that keeps my husband going. He lost his job and this and that. And I realize that I actually do reach people and touch people in some ways. At Field & Stream, I really didn't realize that because the magazine stood between me and the readers. And so that was a surprise when I started writing the novels, that I would come to have really relationships with a large number of people who read my books and who I then occasionally see, you know. And it's very beneficial because it's such a lonely job. And for me, I'm always filled with self-doubt. And it's not like I think I can write these books because I've already written six. Every book seems like I'm failing constantly. So if I get a piece of reader mail that day that tells me how much the books mean to them, it gives me a little bit of a jolt, like to go back to the book and, you know, with a little bit more confidence or more in the right spirit. So it's valuable to have people who read your books.
McCafferty lives in Bozeman, Montana. Look for more information about him and his book at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.